I can, sometimes if I'm using a very thin brush, like a pencil brush, then I can use the colour neat sometimes and just sort of flick around with it just on the surface. So you get two or three variations of colour just within the same sort of batch.
Hi, I'm Bob Acton, and I'm happy to share my conversation with Richard Wilson, a potter in England who does just fantastic work with bright and vivid colors on his pots. He and I talk about his journey to his current style, how he approaches his use of colored slips, and his ideas for ceramic artists wanting to explore more color in their surface design. You can check Richard's work on his website and Instagram page, which you'll find referenced on the show notes.
Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Welcome to the Color and Ceramics podcast, Richard. Really glad that you're here. You know, I really love your work. I am really fascinated with the color and the intensity and the boldness that your work really portrays. So I really appreciate you being here to talk a bit about that. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about you and your work and, you know, when you started in ceramics, how it evolved for you, those kind of things.
Sure. Okay. Well, my background was really coming out of art college for maybe two-year course, which wasn't that sort of focused on ceramics, but it was a multimedia course. But then at the end of it, I sort of focused on ceramics as being my major sort of interest. I thought, being practical, I thought, I could actually make a living out of making things. You know, I thought maybe fine art was a bit sort of out there, not really kind of able to sort of market it in the same way. Anyway, so that was the focus, I think. But fortunately, I was able to get an apprenticeship with a local potter in Norwich, which was in the east of England. So I really worked with him for about 4 years, maybe five years as an apprentice. And then from there, I kind of met with other people. That was, it had a workshop that had a lot of transient potters coming through it for a short time. There was a New Zealand potter there at the time, and a bit later on there was another English potter who had actually set up his workshop in Tasmania. And so I sort of got to know these other potters, and after about 5 years, I said, this was in the late 70s, so I still had sort of my youth on my side to sort of go off and explore the world. So that was my kind of emphasis of wanting to sort of get out and do it. So I went to Australia and New Zealand for 2 or 3 years and sort of worked with these guys. And through that, I was able to kind of build my apprenticeship.
Cool. Very cool.
Because it was very much kind of working with people that I would call them sort of pioneers of making a studio, you know, building a studio, building a workshop, finding local clays, making glazes, sourcing wood from local wood suppliers, and then sort of just actually constructing a workshop around local materials. Because, I mean, in some areas of Australia and New Zealand, it's not that easy to get stuff. You know, you don't go down to the local ceramic suppliers. There isn't one, basically. You have to import it in a lot of ways or drive a long way to get it, which isn't really their scene. So I learned a lot by just being with these potters, and it was very interesting. And then I came back to Europe and wanted to spend more time exploring the European history of ceramics, and I kind of had this idea of wanting to delve back into the wood-fired salt glaze style of central France. That area of central France had a really interesting style of making pots, and they had these big kilns that were sort of through draft kilns, but they were very basic, and they used to build these things and made pots that had lids on them that were flat, which were then the shelves for the next pot. So they didn't have shelves as such. They just put pots on top of pots. And so that was a style that was sort of very familiar with that part of France. And I loved that because I knew a potter who was working in that area. So I spent some time with him. And so that sort of gave me a sort of leap into Europe. So I spent some more time. I had an opportunity to actually go to Germany to work with a German potter. And I actually ended up working with him for about 5 years. Right. So from that was making salt glaze domestic ware in this big kiln, over 100 cubic foot kiln, wood-fired kiln. And we just made lots of domestic ware. And it was quite fun because there was lots of us in the workshop, about 8 of us. And we used to sell on the markets every week. We used to go to the local town markets, and some of them were a lot further away. But that was just the way it was over there. And you kind of got to know lots of people that way.
Sounds like
them at market.
Yeah, it sounds like that not only did you get the experience of building a studio from the ground up, as you did in New Zealand, but also started to really touch on people from around the world and build those relationships with other potters.
Yeah, that's right, because I think that's so important. I think it's one of those things with ceramics, you can take it anywhere in the world. You might not speak the language, but you speak the craft.
Yeah.
And you can actually go into a workshop and sort of say, can I make a pot? And they would understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But there are some workshops that I find it just quite difficult. I think if you went to some parts of India, they would have a very sort of simple sort of momentum wheel and throwing off a hump, and that would be more challenging.
Yes, I think that would be challenging. I've seen some people in Asia who sit on the ground and work a pot, and so I think, wow, that would certainly be a challenge. So I was really interested in kind of the evolution of your work, and as I said at the beginning, I love your bright, strong colors that you're using, but you've also now talked about working in a salt kiln and working in France, and was your work always this colorful?
No, it was very much working with I was a thrower. I was trained as a thrower in the workshop in Norwich. So I never actually got to do any decorating.
Ah.
It was always somebody else's job to do the decorating. But I observed it. And towards the end, I suppose, of the time there, I did it a little bit. But it was very kind of a design that was repetitive. It was a fairly floral kind of idea that you put on a pot. And it was, I suppose, that was there. Kind of seen their development, and they had a kind of a repeat pattern that went around the pot, and it was kind of okay, but it was a bit boring.
Yeah, that was the word that popped into my mind when you said that.
And then I wanted to just get out and see what other potters were doing and different techniques, because if you're just brought up in one workshop and one style of work, you miss out on so many areas of ceramics. I mean, from like earthenware right through to porcelain, there's so many kind of variables. And I'm a bit of a magpie in that respect. I like picking up on ideas.
Yeah, for sure.
I like delving into sort of things. I still do. I still like to sort of pick and choose a bit. Say, let's try this and try that. So I guess that idea of wanting to sort of develop my style came out of having all these ideas floating around in my head. But when I was in Germany particularly, that was when I picked up on another style of design, because I went to Eastern Europe at the time. This is before the Berlin Wall and the communist bloc sort of collapsed, and it was more difficult to get into Hungary and Romania. But there was a potter I worked with, an English chap, in this workshop in Germany, and he'd been over to Hungary quite a few times, and he'd poked around in these old markets and places, and he found some lovely old pots and dishes that were decorated in a very traditional Hungarian way and slip design.
Yeah,
that was that tradition. It was very floral tradition, picking up on stories around villages. You know, there were like people getting married, celebration plates and things like that, and scenes of things like that, birds and animals and things like that. So they used to slip decorate bowls and jugs and things like that. And I just loved the simplicity of that. And slip design was something I hadn't really sort of thought about too much. So that was something that inspired me, really. And there was an English girl in this workshop in Germany that was doing a little bit of slipware on stoneware pots. She used to make some lovely fish and bird designs on these pots, but for herself. It wasn't necessarily a part of the production, but she just did it for herself. And I loved the way she was decorating. So that idea of slipware with a slip trailer sort of got me thinking. And when I came back to England, that was really when I had to sort of pull all these things together and think, well, what do I do? You know, do I go down the salt glaze route or the stoneware route or go down the earthenware route? So it was finding a place where I could actually define what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And that took several years. I mean, I'm not saying that was sort of like overnight. You know, it's an evolutionary thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I had that thing in my head thinking, oh, this is where I want to go to, but it's finding the right techniques to achieve it.
It's a lot of experimentation, isn't it? I think, you know, you got to, at least in my experience, I have to try something. I have, like you, a million ideas, a million things interest me, but I've got to pull out something and then experiment with it. Is that what happened with you over the years of experimentation?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that I thought, well, I've got an idea and I'm not quite sure whether that works. So you kind of have to play with it. I think playing is a sort of an essence of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't enjoy play in ceramics, then you're kind of losing the the heart of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Otherwise it becomes kind of too structured and too kind of formulaic, you know. I think what I do is particularly is a lot looser.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I want to, I suppose, more loose in that sense.
Yeah. Well, you got to have, it seems like your work has a lot of energy to it. And it's almost like that energy is embedded in the pot itself. And that's what I hear you saying around play, too, that play's got to have that positive energy to it.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I started off with making pots that were well-defined in the sense that they were functional and then they had a strong form.
Yeah.
Quite simple. I don't like pots that are too embellished with other things. I mean, I know some potters who don't make any handles on their pots at all for that reason, and they decorate, and that becomes a kind of embellishment. And I suppose I incorporate a bit of both, you know. I do things that have function, yet become a one-off sort of work of art. I call it art on the table for that reason.
Yeah, absolutely.
Put on the board.
Yeah. Now, how did you learn about color and design? Like, you watched other people. Were there other things that you learned, like resources or books you went to or something that helped you refine that focus?
Not really. I don't think I've actually I think it's this idea of having subliminal ideas over the years. You kind of pick up on these things. I mean, I'm very interested in fabric design and wallpaper design and just interiors. And I suppose the strongest influence is probably the color part of it anyway, is impressionist artists, you know, with, you know, like Monet and Cezanne and all those sort of painters that understood color. So I loved that because they were kind of, they picked up on light and shade and spontaneity. You know, they worked outside. So they weren't sort of in a studio all the time, sort of copying photographs or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, they're out there in the elements. You know. And I quite like that idea of decorating. You know, I was sort of be quite direct. So I was making pots that I could decorate straight onto the surface. So I don't bisqueware and decorate. I decorate on dryware.
And then fire once.
Well, I could do. It's just because of the nature of how I work, I bisque fire anyway. Because I can, the glaze seems to fit better. I mean, there were some things that I once fire. Things that I can get away with. I mean, things like teapots. I do teapots that have got lots of, I call them little sculptures. Little things going on, and then, you know, teapots with feet. So, yeah, and I quite like to have to bisque fire them because if there's a little crack or a little thing that hasn't worked out, you know, I can...
You can fix it.
Fix it on the way.
So we'll talk about your technique in a minute because it sounds like you're using slipware, is it? Do you use slipware or... underglazes, just slipware, right?
No, just colored glaze.
How does your selection of the color affect the mood of the piece or the impact on the person who's got the piece in their hand or using it?
I think that's quite difficult to sort of answer sort of easily because it's very subliminal. I have a sort of balance of ideas. The design has to work with the shape of the pot. So I started off really making designs that filled the shape of the pot. I didn't want to just end up in a design that just fitted within the shape. Like if you were making a dish and you just decorated the central part of it, you know, and I wanted a design that just went right through to the edge. But it's knowing how to do that without making it look as if it's fallen off.
I know exactly what you mean.
So I picked shapes of pots and built a design that complemented it. You know, so if it was a curve, then I started off with the curve in the design. So it kind of it echoed the shape of the pot. There is a design that looks like something of the shape in there. Or if it's a straight-sided, like a mug or a vase or something that's it's got straight sides, then I can actually be a bit more angular about it. And using straighter lines, and I think I'm working more towards that because it's more letting the pot dictate the design rather than the other way around. Although I kind of like the idea of them working together. I don't want them sort of to be sort of fighting against each other. You know, the pot and the design has to be a kind of a complementary thing.
It sounds like that what you then use is your brush strokes need to match the form itself.
So I start off with darker colors as a sort of an entry point of the design, and that kind of lays it down quite heavily, but then I sort of overplay it, over design it with other patterns that kind of complement the design. Like if it was a black, then I complement that with red. Black and red work quite well together. If I start off with a dark blue, then I often go with a lighter blue or a green, because those colors work well together. Mm-hmm. So it's understanding what colors work together, and when they're sitting together, do they complement each other? There are some colors that don't work so well. This time of year, I suppose red and green kind of work quite well together. Yes. But often they don't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's because we're doing this interview around Christmas, right? So that's what you're thinking of. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
There are some colors that I find, they're going to work. I think when an orange bangs into a blue or something, it's sometimes a bit of a clash, but it's, I don't know, it's hard to sort of get it right always. And I don't always think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of have an idea of this is the palette of colors that I'm working with. Let's try these two together and see what happens. And it's thinking of colors and patterns together. And, you know, I have to get into the rhythm and the flow of it. And that's why I often decorate on small pieces, mugs or something. Mm-hmm. I have lots of them to decorate. So it really kind of loosens up my design work.
Mm.
After about 20 mugs, you know, I can sort of feel relaxed enough to then move on to a bigger piece.
Oh, that's really interesting. So rather than doing just one big piece and leaving it, you have a process, it sounds like, where you get into a flow. And you do that with some smaller pieces like mugs, and you do multiple ones using the same palette, and then that works you up to a bigger piece that's awaiting you when you're ready.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I use the smaller pieces as trials, and little experiments, and leaving gaps and playing around with the patterns and thinking, oh, I haven't tried that bit before. You know, it doesn't matter so much on a small piece. You can kind of get away with it.
Yes.
But then after a while, I think, oh, I'll remember that and use that on a bigger piece. Yeah.
Very cool. And do you set your palette out, your selection of slips, I guess, that you've got in your buckets? Are they always the same colors you have in front of you when you start your coloring process, or do you pre-select them?
I have about 8 colors I work with. And often, I used to be very kind of precise about it, you know, like mixing, 25% of color to 75% of slip, you know.
Yeah.
That was kind of, that was the sort of the mix, you know, because I didn't want the color to fall off, you know, peel off. So there has to be a high proportion of clay in the mix. So I thought, well, that should work. And then after a while, I thought, well, I don't really need to work it out percentage-wise. I just use it as a color match, you know. So I get my colors often from a supplier that have strong colors anyway. So it's about half a dozen, I guess. Good colors that I use from a supplier. And within that, I can get 2 or 3 variations of it.
Mm-hmm.
Just using stronger or less of it in the mix. And often I just, sometimes if I'm using a very thin brush, like a pencil brush, then I can use the color neat sometimes and just sort of flick around with it just on the surface. So you get 2 or 3 variations of color just within the same sort of batch of like a blue or a green or a red. You know, I can go from almost pink through to sort of poppy red.
Yeah. So depending on the saturation of the pigment in the slip.
So how I mix it up, you know, I'm not I'm sort of less careful these days about how I mix it up. So I can be quite messy. So there's sort of things going on my decorating bench with sort of sponges and bits of slip trailers and things like that. So often I kind of mix one brush with the other.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sometimes yeah. you sort of a double mix and you get sort of two colors on the brush, you know, that kind of works quite nicely sometimes.
So it sounds like that you're not really rigid about that. You're not cleaning your brush and making sure that it's exactly this color. You're in a much more flow state, I might think, about sort of being spontaneous about moving that color onto the piece.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I've looked at artists, you know, how they work, and they seem to have more paint on the floor than they do on the canvas.
Yeah.
Whereas some painters can be very kind of precise, you know, and they have everything lined up on the wall, and they've all the brushes lined up, and all. I find, just loosen up.
Yeah, I guess that's just personality, right, and style how you're more of a loose guy, and that really works for you. And because I think that's what you've said all along, is that I want this energy, I want this spontaneity, I want this energy attached to my pieces, and it would be pretty hard to do that if you were super precise about the application, I guess, of the slip. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the craftsmanship of being precise, because there's a control there that I've kind of moved away from. I suppose because I've done it in the past, I was thinking, I want to do something different now. And I suppose the older you get, the more relaxed you get about certain things.
Yeah, I think so. But when I look at your forms, though, I see a lot of precision in the form itself. So you're being very precise about how you make your teapots and bowls and forms and vases and so on, as opposed to the free-flowing nature of the color application.
Yeah. I'm kind of thinking I should maybe look at the forms in a similar way as I do the decorating. So some of the pots I've been making lately have been a bit looser. You know, I sort of add things to them in terms of slip, so there's more texture on the surface. Yeah. And you know, if you go too much that way, then there's too much going on. You know, it's like what you're trying to say. You know, it's you're sort of throwing the bucket at the pot.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we could switch for a second, because you've talked very eloquently about your style and how you've learned it, and what would you suggest for a young ceramic artist? What advice might you give them about developing their unique style?
I think it's very important to sit and watch other craftsmen and get involved in an apprenticeship, or at least being able to work with other potters. Because I've met a lot of craftspeople that have come out of college, and they don't know a lot about the actual material that they're working with. They don't understand clay. They don't understand glazes. Kilns tend to be plug it in, put on the timer, and let the kiln do the work.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think if you kind of in an environment where you have to do things from the bottom up, then you really understand how to overcome mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of what things have gone wrong, you know, why glazes don't work, or why that firing doesn't work. You know, there's sort of understanding the chemistry and the physics of what goes on in clay.
That makes a lot of sense. I know with I used to do a lot of woodworking, and in lots of ways I found it fairly simple compared to clay, because it's so complex and there's so many things that can go wrong. You do really need to have that depth of understanding. So I hear what you're saying there.
Yeah, well, it's so important to have the right teacher as well to guide you through all. Otherwise, you flounder around. I mean, I know one or two young potters that stick to what they've been trained to do, I suppose, at college. So they've worked with either white porcelain or white earthenware, which is like porcelain. Or they just love to go the other direction. They go off and work with someone, help them fire a wood kiln for a week, you know, yeah. Do that sort of thing. So that's probably the best way to learn, is being in an environment where you're meeting and working with other potters.
Yeah.
But I suppose travel is another great way to discover things, especially in parts of Europe. They're still making some fantastic pots in very traditional ways. And there's lots of good workshops out there that would love to have the young apprentices for a short while.
So traveling, which was really key for you, I think, as I've heard you talk about, all over the world, connecting with people, seeing how they did their work, helped you really come up with what you love to do today. And I can see why that would be a really helpful thing for people to do, to learn their craft.
Well, yeah, because it is a worldwide craft. You know, you can go from southern South America right through to Asia, things like that, where, you know, they're all making pots. And they've been doing it for thousands of years.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just in Turkey, and so had an opportunity to see some of the work there, and it's really good to see the different cultural aspects of things and how they work with things. I know I had a teacher of mine who was from Romania, and so he brought a different angle to the conversation, which was really helpful.
Did you find that you understood the sort of the cultural background to it as well, because a lot of these styles come from functionality. You know, they built either their kiln around the pots, or they built the pots around how they were used. You know, they were made for particular use in the kitchen, and putting food in and things like that. So that was the way they were designed. You know, they're beautiful pots. I mean, but they were built for a reason.
Really based
sitting down the design.
Yeah, for sure. Really based in the functional aspect of things, for sure. Right. That was really, I think, the history of pots and pottery was really in that specific realm. Can you tell us about a challenge that you had in your work? You know, a problem that you had, or an area where you struggled, and how you overcame that?
I suppose it's taking your designs or your techniques to certain limits of actual design. So I'm thinking of my flat form pots that I do, which are basically look like pots, but they're very narrow. They're built only about sort of 4 inches wide, I suppose, at the base, but they could be over a foot thick, you know, wide. I suppose they're almost like silhouettes or shadow pots. But I designed them really for two reasons. Because I moved the workshop and I decommissioned a sort of big kiln I had. And so I moved a smaller kiln, which I could transport quite easily. And when I set up again, I wanted to make biggish pots in a small kiln. So I thought making them flat would sort of sort that one out.
Yeah.
I had this slab roller given to me, and so I wanted to experiment with that really and to make these slab pots. So that was kind of where the problem started, was sort of having the right sort of clay for that technique. Because once you start making big pots, sort of flat, then the stress tension across the surface area in a kiln, you know, the shrinkages and the tensions that go on in the firing. So I used to lose a lot by cracking that went on. So, and that was to do with either firing them too fast or just making sure I had the right type of clay for that sort of a shape. And also the size. If I went over a certain width, then I started to have problems. But so I kind of reined them in a bit. So I'm making them about, I suppose, about, let me get a tape measure. I suppose they're about 40 centimeters wide. And about 50 high. And then I'm looking at 10 centimeters wide at the base. But the actual pot can be less than that. You know, could be like 8 or 9 in actual width all the way to the top. But they have a base to them to make them more stable.
But, just
making pots like that creates problems.
But it sounds like you solved that problem by experimenting with different sizes, different clays, different temperatures, different firing speeds, until you got it just right.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I suppose the other problem I've found is putting big pots in a small kiln. That is always a big one that creates problems because it's to do with the unevenness of a kiln. And a biggish pot in, like firing one pot in a kiln, you know, if it's just that size, always has problems of cracking or something. Whereas if you put a big pot in a big kiln, it kind of sits well in it. That's what I've found.
Thanks very much, Richard. I really appreciated you taking the time here today with us. And for our audience, I think this has been super helpful for people to understand a bit more about how to get to the beautiful work that you're doing and how people themselves can find a way to create their own design and their own colors and images that they use.
Yeah, well, I hope people will start to appreciate a bit more color in ceramics, because I think it's been overlooked, I think, by potters in some ways. You know, I think a lot of potters are a bit afraid of color. They're not quite sure what to do with it. You know, they either go down the garish route, and that kind of gets too embellished, too sort of in your face. And I suppose because I'm using terracotta, the colors are a bit more muted. They're not that sort of industrial color look. There's sort of a natural terracotta sort of coming through the surface a bit. That's the surface.
I do like that dark clay coming through myself, so I appreciate what you're saying for sure. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. We'll put in our notes links to your website and to your Instagram page and so on, so people can find out about you. Is there any other place online that you'd like people to find out about you? I know you also do courses, don't you? So you teach in your studio.
Yeah, I've got, well, it tends to be a very much a one-to-one at the moment, because people kind of ring up or they email me and say, can I do a course? And I say, yeah, but I haven't got many people lined up. Just come.
Come on by. Yeah.
Yeah. Drop in. We'll make a pot together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do that. I'm not geared up for lots of people. I suppose two or three would be more comfortable than a whole workshop full of them, because it's probably because of the way I work. I like to sort of get on and do a bit of work myself while they're practicing. So, yeah. Well,
that's good. So that's another angle that people can connect with you on.
Yeah, is... you can find that on my website.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. But also, I was thinking of the other areas that you can find my work. I don't know. I suppose Instagram and Facebook. I don't do much on Facebook, more Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I use Instagram as like a brochure, sort of keeps people up to date with ideas and things like that.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for spending your time with us. I really appreciated the conversation here today.
Yeah. Well, if you get lots of interest, you must do it again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And next time I'm in the UK, I'll make sure I come by and we'll have a conversation. I would love to see your studio.
Yeah, you too. That's good. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.